Humans identify suffering in other humans by universal signs. People sob, wince, cry out, put voice to their hurt. Animals have no universal language for pain. Many animals don't have tear ducts. More creatures still, prey animals, for example, instinctively mask symptoms of pain, lest they appear weak to predators. Recognizing that a non-human animal is in pain is difficult, often impossible.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. Today's conversation is with Natasha Daly. Natasha is a writer and editor at National Geographic, where her investigative reporting focuses on animal welfare and exploitation. She wrote the June cover story for the magazine. It's called Suffering Unseen: The Dark Truth Behind Wildlife Tourism. If you haven't read it yet, read it. These days, it's hard to scroll through social media without seeing pictures of friends or celebrities on vacation posing with animals. Like the post you see about bathing elephants in Thailand or sloth selfies in South America, these pictures may seem fun and harmless or even helpful to animals. But as Natasha uncovered, there's a dark underbelly to wildlife tourism. Natasha and photographer Kirsten Luce spent a year on four continents investigating this story. I'm really excited to have Natasha here today.
I started at National Geographic 4 years ago, and I remember actually on my very first day of work, there was an all-staff meeting, and our editor-in-chief, Susan Goldberg, was announcing this new project that we had coming up called Wildlife Watch, which was going to be this journalistic investigative project looking at ways that animals are exploited around the world. And so I remember sitting in that meeting and watching on the screen these pictures of slaughtered elephants lying on the ground and just feeling this overwhelming sense of this is really what I want to be doing. So I think the seed was kind of planted at that point. And it wasn't until a few months later that I really started diving into animal coverage. And since then, writing about animal exploitation and welfare has really much been my beat. And I think what kind of most drives me to want to tell these stories is that, you know, animals don't have voices, so they're not able to tell their own stories. So sometimes it's up to us as journalists to share those.
For National Geographic, have they had many cover stories that have been animal welfare?
We actually had a cover story a few years ago on the elephant ivory trade. And that was, you know, a story about animal crime right on the cover of our magazine. I think that the wildlife tourism story was kind of the first of its kind for us. This is really was a dedicated animal welfare story as opposed to a conservation story. I can't say for sure without going through our archives, but I think it's probably the first dedicated animal welfare story that's been on our cover.
Animal welfare and conservation back in the day were really separate camps, but it feels like those camps are combining or merging. Do you feel that in your work?
Yeah, I think it's tough because, you know, often those two concepts are in conflict. Often conservationists will sort of look down on welfare advocates as bleeding hearts. And then often animal welfare advocates will say conservationists are too focused on the big picture and not on individual sufferings. Historically, I think very much sometimes the two camps can be in conflict. But I think in order to make any progress forward for animals, in the really grand scheme, it's imperative that the two kind of camps work together and realize the ways that they overlap.
And for people who haven't read your story, could you just give us a brief overview?
Yeah, so this is a story on captive wildlife tourism. This all began a couple years ago in the Amazon rainforest when photographer Kirsten Luce and I were there to document situations where local residents were actually pulling wild animals out of the jungle and keeping them in captivity for tourists to come and interact with. And this was an experience that we realized was really exacerbated by social media and the drive people seem to have for these souvenir photos that they could post on Instagram, for example, and share with their friends. So that story got a lot of reader attention. People were very interested in this concept of captive wildlife tourism and how social media is fueling it. So we decided that we wanted to tell a bigger story because by no means was this sort of exploitation of animals for tourism only going on in the Amazon. In fact, it's something that all over the world, and it's been becoming, I think, over especially the past decade, more and more popular because of social media. So what we did is we pitched a global story. It was 2018, and we thought the time was right to really delve into this issue and to look at how it was really affecting all kinds of different species and individuals within those species who were being exploited for these activities. We spent about a month in Thailand, where we were looking at elephants and tigers that were provided for tourists to ride and to hold and to get close to. We spent time in Russia, where we were looking at these traveling dolphinariums, as well as a growing trend with social media influencers doing photo shoots with wild animals in the forest. We also went to Hawaii, where we were looking at different sort of experiences with dolphins, whether it's swimming in captivity or in the wild. And then, of course, we wrapped in the Amazon as well. So it was truly a kind of a multi-pronged look at this industry around the world.
Starting with Thailand, there were two elephants in particular that you mentioned quite a bit in your story. Glai Hom, is that his name?
Yes.
And Mina.
Yes.
I think one thing your story really illustrated by talking about both of them was how their day-to-day lives are and what they live with and experience.
Yeah. So first of all, I think that this is a universal thing with all of these animals, is that because you as a tourist are only seeing these animals for maybe a few hours while you're on vacation, you go, you get your photos, then leave. It's really difficult to even comprehend what the day-to-day life is for these animals. And I think that that was one thing I really wanted to be able to do with this story, was to be able to show the reader what these animals are like day in and day out, over and over and over, when the tourists go home. So elephants, I think, are a great example. We met hundreds of elephants in Thailand in captivity. There were a few that I really was able to kind of spend time with and learn about what their actual individual lives are like. One of them was named Mina, and she was 4 years old, and she lived at a very traditional kind of standard Thai elephant camp. And what I learned is that her life is actually pretty monotonous. She performs in a couple shows every day. She paints pictures. Her mahout or trainer actually directs her movements as she paints with a nail that presses into her head. And then when she's done performing, she'll take selfies with tourists and then be brought back to her stall. It's a small stall, and then she's chained up. The vast majority of elephants in this industry are kept on chains. And I noticed with Mina in particular, the chain, the shackle around her foot had spikes on the inside of it, pressing into her flesh so that it hurt for her to put her foot down. And so she kept it kind of hanging in the air. Another elephant that we met that really stayed with me, I actually found him behind a performance stadium at a crocodile farm outside of Bangkok. His name was Glai Hom, and he was also a juvenile elephant. And he was by far in the worst shape we saw of any of the elephants we encountered in Thailand. He had a bent, swollen leg, a bloody wound at his temple, and he was very emaciated. We ended up reporting his situation to contacts who were able to file a police report. But beyond that, I think that his story really resonated with our readers because his suffering was so visible. After our magazine story published, we received an outpouring of concern about that particular elephant from readers around the world. People were calling for his rescue. People were insisting that he get care. People were reaching out to elephant rescue organizations in Thailand, asking them if they could help. And the challenge is that elephants are classified as livestock in Thailand. So they're property. They can be owned, and you know, the owner can do with them what they please. So the concept of rescue with an elephant is very difficult. As it turns out, because of all of the kind of outcry around his situation, one organization called the Save Elephant Foundation was able to negotiate his purchase in Thailand in order to transfer ownership. Typically, a purchase would have to be made or an elephant would have to be leased. In this case, he was purchased. It's never something I thought would ever happen, but Glai Hom has now started a new life at a elephant sanctuary in the northern part of the country. And I've seen this just happened last week, so it's very new. I've seen some photos of him in his new open enclosure, living off a chain for maybe the first time in his life. And it's absolutely incredible to see. I think that it speaks to the power that people have to invoke change when they really care about something. I think it also shows that storytelling really can make an impact. And I think that was the thing we hoped out of this whole story, that it would make some sort of real world impact. And it seems to have.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. Not to put a damper on such wonderful news, but will he be replaced with another elephant?
That's, of course, the concern. So, right. Of course, when you pay to buy an elephant, one criticism of that, sort of exchange is that, well, then the owner might go out and use that money to buy a new animal. Of course, that's a possibility. Save Elephant Foundation said they did pay under market value for him. Nonetheless, it's definitely a controversial way to save animals.
How do people, if someone is going to Thailand and they've read your story and they really want to see elephants mm-hmm. without causing harm or giving money to a harmful industry, how do they go about it?
First of all, say you do a Google search for elephant sanctuary in Thailand. A whole bunch of results are going to come up. I know because I've done this search several times. What you really want to do is if you hone in on a place that seems to look good, the photos are good, they say all the right things on the screen. And by the right things, I mean, they don't offer rides, for example, or they show elephants sort of roaming in natural habitats. You really want to dig a little deeper. You want to read reviews. Often reading the 1- and 2-star reviews are where you will find animal welfare concerns if people have detailed them. You kind of want to see if the experiences they're offering are more observational or if they're more interactive. And if you're looking for an experience where an elephant doesn't have to be trained for that experience, it's those observational experiences that you're going to want to look for.
Let's talk about tigers for a minute mm-hmm. too, because the tiger selfie industry, I didn't realize how huge it was. Mm-hmm. It's enormous.
Yeah.
And it's Thailand is the hub.
Right.
So tell us what you learned and where you visited.
With the tiger experiences, again, this is very high in demand experience when you go to Thailand. And there are a couple different experiences you can have. One involves people posing with adult tigers in a cage. But one of the things people don't realize about these experiences is that in order to be safe for this grown predator to be with humans, often what we found is that tigers are drugged or they're declawed or both. And then you have the tiger cub snuggling. So this is very, very popular baby tiger cubs that you can hold and take photos with. And I think what people may not know is that tigers are only at that age where they're small and cuddleable and cute for a very short amount of time. It's actually weeks. And so in order to offer this experience year-round for people, companies always have to have new tigers available to cuddle. And what that means, what we found when we looked into it, was there's often speed breeding. So, female tigers are bred repeatedly and their cubs are removed from them often shortly after birth to be ready for these tourist encounters.
These are two totally different industries, the tigers and the elephants. And elephants in Thailand are a massive part of the economy. Mm-hmm. What, when you would talk to owners and mahouts, what was the line of defense with the shows?
So animals in Thailand are classified as domestic, or sorry, I should say captive elephants in Thailand are classified as domestic animals. They are livestock, so they're equivalent to donkeys or horses. So they can legally be owned by a private owner, and the private owner can do essentially whatever they want with them. So there, first of all, is that framework that exists, that they're livestock and they're there to be used for human. Traditionally, they were used for logging, and then the logging industry was made illegal in 1989. And so there was sort of this transition to street bagging with elephants. And then from there's a transition to tourism. So they've always traditionally been used in concert with people to do various work. And so that often is the line of defense that, people and elephants have worked together in Thailand for generations. And that is true. But even if they were born in captivity or to have those close relationships, elephants have also been trained over and over again. And that's how they're docile enough to interact.
Let's just talk about social media a little bit, because in your article, you say how much it's driving this industry. So how can you talk a little about that and what you saw? And
yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that what social media does is it almost legitimizes what you see. If a family member or a friend or an acquaintance or a celebrity posts a photo of themselves riding or bathing an elephant, for example, A, you may want to go and do that activity as well, but B, because it's maybe someone you know and trust, it almost legitimizes it in your mind. So I think that's a big risk. I also think that what social media does is it puts these activities right there in front of your face. So say you're just at home scrolling through your phone idly, you may come across someone on vacation holding a baby tiger, and you might think, wow, that looks incredible. I'm adding Thailand and this experience to my bucket list. Whereas, you know, previously, before social media, you would maybe learn about these activities through guidebooks or word of mouth. And what it ultimately does at the end of the day is it serves as viral advertising for these experiences. So they're everywhere.
Western tourists, at least, it really seems like it's changed from people now go to bathe elephants or be in the river with the elephant because it's become more and more known that riding is really harmful.
Yeah.
And so now bathing or touching, those kind of experiences have become much more the norm.
Yes.
But are they any better?
Yes. I think you raise a great question because you're exactly right. So I think it's become more universally known that there's something off or something wrong with riding. People are increasingly seeking more ethical, natural experiences. And you'll notice if you do a Google search for Thailand Elephant Sanctuary, many of the results that pop up on the page are these bathing experiences. So these have become much more popular with tourists. I think they're seen as much more natural because it's, you know, you and an elephant and, you know, a river or a mud pit or something. You're not on the elephant's back. And of course, it's fun and playful for this elephant to get a bath. But I think what people don't realize is that a single elephant may be getting 8 baths a day with different tour groups coming through. Second of all, and I think this is most important, in order for an elephant to stand there and be docile enough for, you know, a bunch of tourists to kind of crowd around and bathe him or her without making a sudden movement that could be dangerous, that elephant has to be trained. And so the problem with bathing ultimately comes down to the fact that even though that environment may genuinely be better for the elephant, they may have more room to roam, they may be, you know, not chained up all day, this activity relies on trained elephants in order to make it possible. So as long as bathing remains popular, these businesses are going to need trained elephants to be available.
Give us just a little background on what the training entails.
Yes, it was really important to me in this story to get to the bottom of the training because it was the kind of situation that I couldn't ultimately tell this story without talking about the root of it. So elephants are genetically wild animals. Even if they were born in captivity, there is no such thing as a domesticized elephant. Because they're genetically wild, they need to be trained or tamed in order to interact safely with humans. So training varies, but in speaking with actual trainers in Thailand who train elephants for a living, I was able to learn that, you know, from a young age, a baby is separated from its mother, and that is a pretty difficult process for both mother and baby. And then when the baby is alone, it's typically trained with an instrument called a bullhook. So a bullhook is a wooden stick with a metal prong at the end. And trainers, you know, the trainer I was speaking with told me, you have to use the bullhook so the elephant will know. And what he meant by that was, you know, you in order to teach the elephant to sit, you pull at its legs with the bullhook, you push from behind with the bullhook. This is an instrument of fear that is used to make elephants docile. And so I think that these fear-based tactics are instrumental in so much of the training for the types of experiences that involve rides and shows and any sort of interaction with this animal.
Well, it's pain too.
Exactly. Yes. So it's pain and it's fear.
There's a passage at the end of your story about pain that really struck me. Would you mind reading it?
Sure. Humans identify suffering in other humans by universal signs. People sob, wince, cry out, put voice to their hurt. Animals have no universal language for pain. Many animals don't have tear ducts. More creatures still, prey animals, for example, instinctively mask symptoms of pain, lest they appear weak to predators. Recognizing that a non-human animal is in pain is difficult, often impossible.
I mean, just hearing you read that makes me want to cry. It's kind of everything that your story is.
Yeah. It's unseen suffering. And I think that's why it's so difficult for a tourist. But at the end of the day, I think what makes it so difficult for the average person to see any potential pain or suffering is because often these animals are just standing there. Mina on the spiked shackle, she wasn't crying out. She was just standing there. And so it can be difficult to relate to an animal's suffering when you can't necessarily see it and when you usually can't hear it.
Well, and I think when you're just coming in, you're getting off a bus or and there's all the animals and here's your moment for the selfie. No one's thinking about before and after. They're thinking about right then and there, and the animals look happy. How do we know?
Well, that's a huge part of it is, you know, many people who do these experiences love animals and they love them, and so they want to get close to them. And so, you know, who would ever want to think that this experience that is bringing you joy is bringing an animal suffering? So it's, you know, it's very easy to think, you know, this experience is fun for me, so it also must be fun for the animal.
But I would imagine with the time you spent and being in all these places with the intent of looking at what they're actually living with and how they got there, you must have seen a lot of pain.
Yeah. You know, and I think the reason I was able to see so much pain is because I was there as a journalist to write a story. And so, yes, I was going over and over and over to these facilities. I was able to revisit places at night with permission from the owner of the facility, for example, to see how they sleep and to see what they're like at night. These are experiences that the average tourist just doesn't have. So I really think I was only able to see these things and detect them because of my sheer exposure to these situations.
Your story is one of those things that, without any shaming, has really opened a lot of people's eyes to, hey, you know, this is actually harmful, or maybe we shouldn't do this, and maybe we should just look from afar. Without making people feel bad, I thought you did a brilliant, brilliant job at just really kind of, it was almost like you were talking to a bunch of friends about like, hey, guess what I learned? You guys, that shouldn't happen anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was talking to a bunch of friends. I was talking to my family in the story. I was talking to my friends. I was talking to, you know, people I went to high school with who might see it on Facebook. I was talking to the average person, because the thing is with the audience for this story is that we are all these tourists. These aren't others that we can point fingers at and say, you know, look how silly they look. Like, these people are you and they're me. And I think we all need to be very aware of that. So shaming people is never something Kirsten and I set out to do in this story. And it was very important to us that no one felt embarrassed or ashamed when they read it, if they recognized themselves in this story.
Can wildlife tourism, is there an upside to it? Can it be a good thing for animals?
Yeah, so wildlife tourism isn't inherently a bad thing. It's a very broad term that can apply to, you know, taking binoculars out into the forest and birdwatching, or going on a boat and, you know, watching whales as the boat kind of goes by, a whale watching tour. But the problem is, and what the facet of wildlife tourism that we were looking at, were these captive encounters with wild animals. And the reason that those are problematic as opposed to, you know, bird watching in a forest is because these animals are inherently wild and they're put in positions where they have to get close to humans. And in order to make that safe, they have to be trained using fear or pain-based methods. So I think that, like, that's the distinction that I want people to take away, is that wanting to see animals is a wonderful thing. But anytime you kind of cross that line from observation to interaction, it indicates that there may be some red flags.
So let's talk about Russia a little bit.
Yeah.
The traveling aquariums, I just had no idea until I read your story.
Yeah, neither did I, actually, until I started looking into it. And Kirsten and I, we found out that there were these traveling aquariums going on in Russia. So essentially what happens is that dolphins and beluga whales are put in trucks, kept in tanks, and carted from city to city, where a pop-up aquarium tent with a pool is set up and they perform shows. And usually they'll stay for 4 to 6 weeks and then they'll move on to the next place. So first of all, this was interesting to us because it was almost the flip side of Thailand. In Thailand, you had people coming from often, you know, the opposite side of the world to see animals. In Russia, what we had was actually animals being brought to the people. And what we found was that, yeah, these shows are going to small towns where people and children may never have the opportunity to see these animals in the wild. I talked to families over and over again. You know, what brings you to the dolphin show today? Why, you know, what appeals about it? And people would say to me over and over, like, this is my child's only opportunity to see these animals. And I'd often have people say, yeah, it's kind of weird, but it's here, so we're going to go. So I think that this shows that there's all different types of demand for these encounters.
Well, and some would say, hey, look, we have no other way of seeing these animals.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with this?
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked to multiple marine mammal experts in Russia who are very aware of these traveling shows. And everyone we spoke to told us that these traveling marine mammal shows represent the worst quality of life for these animals in the country, much more so than the kind of stationary aquariums where you can go and watch shows where they're stationary.
And it does bring up the issue, and I've heard this a lot from people, the thing with responsible or ethical tourism and money. And of course, if you're wealthy, a wealthy tourist, they can go look at a safari, mm-hmm. It's much easier access,
yep.
in a lot of ways to kind of an ethical way of viewing animals versus Russia. I'm sure a lot of the people in these small towns don't leave their small town very
right.
often.
Yeah.
And so there's an argument there. I'm not saying I'm for the argument that, hey, this is all we got.
Yeah. I mean, that was what was said to me over and over, it's here. It may not be ideal, but I want to bring my child to see the belugas because
right.
they're here, and it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. And that sort of once in a lifetime factor is something that would come up over and over again, no matter where I was. So yeah, I mean, I think it ultimately comes down to the individual. Yes, it may be a once in a lifetime opportunity for you to see a beluga whale up close. But knowing about the circumstances in which they are living, often the circumstances in which they are caught from the wild, specifically for these shows, once you know that, is this something that you want to continue to support? And that is going to come down to individual decisions. And, you know, it's something that I can't answer for people. It's something that people ultimately have to answer for themselves. It really is ultimately up to the individual to make their own ethical decisions.
Well, and on some level, you're not really seeing a beluga whale. You're seeing a beluga whale in captivity and in kind of the worst possible circumstance.
It's a very different situation than
right.
seeing a beluga, you know, in the
in
wild.
The ocean.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then one more animal I want to talk about, dolphins. And this is Hawaii where you guys mm-hmm. were. And people still swim with dolphins. I hear people swimming with dolphins all the time, but the swimming with dolphins seems to have less of a cultural stigma than a lot of these
other
ones.
We talked about that in the story a little bit about how dolphin shows have been shunned a little bit in the US. There's been lots of petitions, lots of backlash against the shows, but the swim experiences are still very popular. And I visited one in Hawaii and I spoke to a tourist who was there. And he spoke about how, you know, he wouldn't watch a show, but he's here and the dolphins are here. And it was an upscale resort where there are veterinarians on staff. The animals are clearly well fed. And so these were all the reasons why he said, you know, I feel okay about doing this. Everyone's nice and friendly, and you know, it's all very transparent because the pool is actually in the middle of the hotel, so you can see the dolphins all day long. I think it's an interesting point, and it ultimately will come down to people's personal decisions and like, what is your threshold for a captive animal encounter? And you know, questioning why are some things kind of out of the question for you and other things aren't? And it's tough, and there are no easy answers, and no one experience is the same as any other experience. For example, the place I visited in Hawaii with veterinarians on staff is not the same situation as the traveling pop-up tent in Russia. And so these are very different situations, and that plays into it too. So I think that you ultimately, as a traveler, it just comes down to doing your homework.
Absolutely. So now you've had a couple months since the story came
out.
What kind of response have you had?
Yeah. So it's tough. So something, it's this private thing for so long and you're working on it, and then all of a sudden it's out in the world. I didn't know how people would react. I hoped that because it was a story that the average person was sort of at the center of, that it would resonate with people. I'm really happy to say that I feel like it has. Especially on social media, I got a tremendous outpouring of comments and questions and people sharing the story. Instagram in particular was really amazing. People were you know, commenting on our posts and sharing the story to their Instagram stories. We started a hashtag, #NatGeoWildlifeTourism, and they were using that hashtag to tag problematic photos that they saw or from their past. Or it was really amazing to see how it kind of resonated with people. I think the biggest challenge for people would say over and over, okay, I think this is horrible, but what can I do individually? And the answer is that there's a lot you can do individually because you as a traveler and consumer and citizen have power to actually change this industry through your own decisions. And I know it seems like, well, what's one decision? Well, one decision becomes multiple decisions that add up. Before you know it, it potentially there's a shift in what people are willing to pay for collectively or not pay for. And I think because social media plays such a role in giving rise to this industry, it's also important to know that it can play a huge role in sort of changing it. So just as people share elephant rides through their Instagram feeds, they can also share things they're concerned about this industry in their Instagram feeds.
I was thinking with shifts, because I was in Thailand with a lot of elephant experts, people who are really trying to change the world for elephants in Asia. And every single one of them had ridden elephants because nobody knew.
Yeah.
And so much of this, it's just sharing knowledge.
Exactly. And I think often there's a shame factor. And I've had people say to me, I'm horrified that I rode an elephant in the past now that I know the truth. But the reality is that you shouldn't be ashamed of things you did that you didn't even know anything about. That's the entire reason we did this story, is to shed light on these issues so that people would say simply, you know, I didn't know, and now I know. And then the answer is, okay, what are you going to do with that information?
When you started reporting, did you already have an awareness as to what you were walking into? Or were there things that just really stunned or shocked you?
There were. That's a great question. We chose to go to Russia and Thailand specifically because we knew there were issues going on there that we wanted to look into. And I think probably for both of us, the most shocking thing was when we were in Russia, we found out that there was a performing polar bear circus. At this point, we were at the end of almost 2 years of reporting on this issue, and we kind of thought we'd seen it all at this point. And then we found out, someone said casually, well, did you hear about the polar bear circus? And we hadn't. So we looked into this, we tracked it down, we changed our plans to fly to this town where it was performing to go witness this. And we did, and there were four polar bears performing on ice. And it just seemed that, I mean, the polar bear is a symbol of conservation globally. To see these animals wearing muzzles and ballroom dancing across the ice was, I think, really shocking for both of us. So that was kind of one of those moments where you're like, wow, you know, it's just when we thought we'd seen everything.
With the Russian owners and trainers, kind of across the board with owners and trainers, because this is so many people's way of making a living and has been for years.
Right.
When you were asking people questions, did you get a lot of pushback on, hey, this is how we feed our children?
Yeah, I mean, so of course. I mean, if any time an industry is someone's livelihood, of course people are going to be deeply defensive of it. And that's to be expected. And that, I think we're very sensitive of that reporting this story. I think that a huge element kind of at play was that many people who have grown up, lived in this world, don't see it as a problem in any way. So I think that helps people often justify what they're doing. And so I think it was really important to us to tell the story from the trainers directly and to speak to people directly to find out their perspective. And I think one of the most important moments for me was I was able to meet a dolphin trainer who it had been her entire life training dolphins for these shows in Russia. And she was at the point where she said to me that she didn't want to do it anymore. She was a whistleblower, and she's a big character in our story because she was able to kind of shed light on what was going on in Russia through 30 years of experience. So I think that that was really important to have that voice in the story. It wasn't just me observing something. It was someone who's lived it for a very long time.
I found her one of the most moving parts of your entire story. She was incredible.
She was very brave. I mean, she said that she was aware that she'd probably lose her job over this. And so the fact that she was willing to speak to me on the record when she felt strongly about it was very important to me. And I think very important for the story. And she was very brave for doing that.
And what about you? Because first of all, you saw so much hard, you know, painful stuff all the time. To keep going and to stay open-minded is tough.
Yeah.
And so how do you feel this changed you? Do you feel like you came out of the 2 years different than when you went in?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Just the nature of reporting such an intense investigative story was it changed me as a reporter. It changed me, I think, as a person. It was being able to see these things up close and actually be there in the field on the ground witnessing them. It was emotionally very difficult, but I think what kept us going was we knew that this is a story that needed to be told because it hadn't been told in this really comprehensive way before. And so that was what got us through those kind of really hard days and tough times. And I think what makes it all worth it is when I get those messages now from people on Instagram. Someone messaged me and said, hi, I'm on vacation. I forget where she was. Actually, I think she was in India. And she said, we're going to ride an elephant up to the temple, but we saw your story yesterday and we had no idea. And we're not going to do it. So
that's awesome.
That to me is incredible because it's someone actually out there traveling, changing their plans because of our story. And so I think it speaks to the power of journalism.
It is so incredibly powerful and effective. And thank you for
writing
it. Thank you, Natasha, so much.
Thanks so much.
If you haven't read Natasha's article on wildlife tourism yet, go to her website. It's natashadaly.com. There are also links to her work on our website, speciesunite.com. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. One way you can do so is to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcast. Another is Patreon. We are on Patreon at patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everyone who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Allison Berenger, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.